Good day from Wall Street. This is Jack Marks for Wall Street Reporter, and joining me today from the great state of Texas is Lance Roberts, Chief Investment Strategist for Clarity Financial and the editor for realinvestmentadvice.com. Lance, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here today.
So, you know, I came across some excellent presentations that your firm has on YouTube and also on your own site, realinvestmentadvice.com, regarding, you know, some of the market bubbles, whether it's you call it the wealth bubble, the stock market bubble, they're being inflated. Now, these posts are probably about a month old, so you know you guys have some great timing. Now, can you kind of bring us up to speed on, you know, what your current position is based on, you know, the recent election results and also today's market rally?
Sure. So a couple of things is that we have to look at is timeframes, which are the most important things. So when we're talking about macroeconomic type issues, these are very long-range views, long-range projections. And one of the biggest mistakes that investors make, and we manage money for clients. We have about $800 million under management. We manage mostly money for people within about 5 years of retirement or 5 years after retirement. That's kind of where the bulk of our clients are. So they're very concerned about capital preservation. Most of them have been through the bear markets in 2000 and 2007. And, you know, while there's a lot of commentary on Wall Street, which suggests that, oh, you just kind of buy and hold and ride it out because markets will always be higher over time. The problem is that for individuals that have money invested, getting back to even is not an investment strategy. It doesn't get you to your goal just getting back to even. And of course, those years that are lost from a bear market to getting back to even to eventually make money is detrimental to long-term financial plans. So we always want to be very careful when we talk about these things to separate out long-term views and long-term analysis versus shorter-term windows of time, say 1 year to 2 years, where markets can do things that, as John Maynard Keynes once said, markets can remain illogical longer than you can remain solvent. So, you know, it's important that in the short term that we make money when we have the opportunity to make money, but in the long term, we understand what these dynamics are in terms of future returns on investments and those type of things. So, having said that, one of the big things that occurred coming out of 2008, and it was as we started into 2009, of course, the Federal Reserve launched these quantitative easing programs, and wasn't just the Federal Reserve, it was central banks globally. And we have had in the United States alone over the last decade, more than $33 trillion worth of money injected into the economic system to try to repair the financial crisis. And that includes, you know, quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3. That's TARP, that's HAMP, it's HARP, it's the, you know, Make Affordable Home program that we did, trying to get people to, you know, back in their homes. That included things such as cash for clunkers and cash for appliances and all the different programs that the government did to try to repair the balance sheets of the economy. And they were successful in stopping a deleveraging cycle that should have occurred. In 2008 and 2009, we should have deleveraged a lot of the excess debt that was in the market. But instead of allowing people to file for bankruptcy, get out of their houses that they couldn't afford, they bought these houses they couldn't afford, and we came up with programs to keep them in houses that they still couldn't afford, and we landlocked them into their houses so that they could not move from areas, say, like Chicago or other places where jobs weren't as plentiful to, say, Texas, where at that time we were having an energy boom and there was lots of jobs available, but they couldn't leave because they were locked into their houses because of these make home affordable type programs to keep them in these houses. So we had never allowed that deleveraging cycle to occur. And because of suppression of interest rates towards zero and this massive amount of liquidity, it encouraged the inflation of assets across the board. And unlike 2000, where we had a bubble in the dot-com technology stocks, and really that was about where most of the bubble was. In 2007, a lot of the bubble was in debt, mortgage-related debt. We now have a bubble that's not only in asset prices in terms of stocks, 33 times earnings, but also we have a bubble in debt in terms of a variety of debt, not just corporate debt, but the quality of corporate debt has now become a bubble because we now have more bonds that are rated less than BBB. A lot of bond funds that people own have a tremendous amount of sub-investment grade quality bonds in their portfolios. And of course, a lot of investors have layered on things that Wall Street likes to term high yield because it's a nice marketable term to get people to buy funds of these higher yielding bonds, which are technically companies that are on the verge of bankruptcy. And we have a tremendous number of companies today that are technically living on low interest rates, using debt to finance things like stock buybacks and dividend issuances. And one of the culprits of that, and one of the casualties of this environment we just saw recently, was General Electric. They are not going to be the last company that we see slashing dividends and trying to restructure balance sheets, trying to avoid bankruptcy over the course of the next few years. But again, like I said, these are longer term issues that are going to take the next couple of 2 or 3 years to play out. So I don't want to confuse these type of issues with shorter term portfolio management, which is, you know, we're still invested in the markets currently. Markets are going up. We have done some technical damage to this market this year. And the trend of the market is looking like it is trying to change, but it has not changed yet. So we're still primarily long the markets. We are holding some more cash here because there is some risk. But the shorter term perspective of the markets is still up. So we want to be invested while markets are rising.
Okay, so your kind of longer term thesis, I guess, let's call it 18 to 24 months or 12 to 18 months.
I'd say our longer term thesis is 24 to 36 months that we're going to have a pretty major debt deleveraging cycle.
Okay. So short term, you see, you know, kind of a bounce up into, when do you actually see this kind of bubble starting to burst?
Well, so timing, as they say, is always the most important thing, right?
Right,
so,
right.
You know, the problem with all of this is that things can last longer than you would expect or that you could logically predict. Things happen. And let me give you a couple of really good examples things that have occurred just recently that you can't count on. But they do change the dynamic of the markets and economic factors, et cetera. So as an example, Donald Trump was elected president 2016, and everybody was very excited. We saw a big surge in confidence just following the election in 2016. And there's been a lot of credit given to the current administration for the surge in economic growth that we saw in the first and second quarter of this year. So the first and second quarter of 2018, we saw these very nice, you know, almost high fours and almost 5% growth rates in the economy on a nominal basis, not inflation adjusted, but on a nominal basis, almost 4.5% growth. And so everybody's like, see, Trumponomics is working. Well, it's not exactly the case. Yes, there was a benefit from tax cuts, which brought in about $300 billion worth of overseas dollars that went primarily into stock buybacks. That has very little impact on creating economic growth. What creates economic growth is things that you and I buy. We are 70% in this economy driven by consumption. So the majority of what we consume is where we get economic growth from. So if tax cuts wasn't the primary driver of economic growth, what was? Well, everybody seems to forget that in late 2017, and I don't forget this because I live in Houston, Texas, but in September of 2017, there were three major hurricanes that impacted the United States. In Houston, we were hit by Harvey. Then you had the hurricane in Florida, of course, the hurricane in Puerto Rico. And then we had two major wildfires out in California. Well, those all required billions of dollars worth of government stimulus that needed to be spent in order to repair that damage. Well, what kind of jobs does that create in the short term? Construction, manufacturing creates a demand for commodities, for trucking. Where have you seen the growth in the economy over the first couple of months? And while everybody's giving credit to Trumponomics for creating, you know, bringing back jobs, manufacturing jobs to America, it really isn't bringing back jobs to America. What it's doing is it's spurring the jobs needed that are rebuilding what was destroyed. You know, there's this old economic theory called the broken window, which is if we break a window, we've got to rebuild it. We create economic activity. The problem with that, the fallacy to that economic theory, is that all you're doing is dragging forward future consumption. So as an example, I have a house. We were damaged by Hurricane Harvey. I had to replace my roof today rather than replacing my roof 5 years from now. So in 5 years, I will not need to spend that money in the future that I spent this past year having my roof redone. So I have now taken forward future consumption, which now leaves a void in the future. So the point to this conversation is that these events, you can't count on, you know, hurricanes coming in. We just had Florence and Michael come in. That's going to create a little short-term little bump in the fourth quarter, first quarter of next year for the same reasons. Got to rebuild that stuff. But that all pulls forward future consumption, leaves a void in the future that has to be filled. And so with us now being in the longest economic cycle on record, we're now moving towards the you know, 10 years of an economic growth cycle with interest rates rising. And when interest rates rise, the cost of borrowing increases, which slows consumption. Wages haven't really grown that much on an inflation-adjusted basis. Yes, nominal wages are up. They're higher than they were now, finally, going all the way back to 1998. But that is far underpaced the actual abilities to sustain the standard of living. There's currently about a $4,000 a year gap between what the average American has coming in terms of wages and salary versus what they is required for them to live on. Of course, that has to all go to credit of some sort. And this is why we look at statistics, and 80% of Americans don't have any money in the bank because it's taking everything they have just to live. And so when interest rates go up, as they are going now, that extracts further liquidity from their coffers and reduces what they can consume in the economy. And so this is why rising interest rates slows economic growth. And once the stimulus from these hurricanes pass through the system, which is already occurring, tax cuts have basically run the entirety of their benefit. Next year, we're going to go back to comparing year-over-year growth rates and earnings. All this begins to fade in 2019. So this is a very long way to answer your question of saying, when is it coming? Our best guess is that we're going to start seeing the early onset of recession in mid to late 2019. And that's where the stock market's going to run into a much bigger problem at that point.
I see. How much of an impact do you think these hurricanes had? Was it that much of a positive impact on the economy in the past year?
Yeah, you know, you're basically pulling forward about $60 billion worth of construction and investment and overall activity. And remember that when you construct something, it has a far different impact on the economy than a service. So, for instance, an Uber driver, he picks you up, he takes you to another place, and he drops you off. Okay, so you pay him, and he has to put gas in his car, so he pays the gas station. So that's really the net effect, mostly, of that service. There's a very low, what we call a multiplier effect of services. Now, when we manufacture something, I've got to pay the contractors, I've got to pay the delivery drivers, the commodity producers, the deliveries of those commodities, the actual the process of repairing and replacing. So the what we call the multiplier effect on manufacturing and construction activity has a much higher flow through in the economy. So for every dollar you spend on manufacturing construction, you create about another $2 to $3 in activity. A service job actually creates has a very, very low multiplier. Government spending actually has a negative multiplier because government spending primarily goes into welfare.
Interesting. So What are some like right? So basically, you're kind of I guess at this point you're cautious. You're short term bullish but cautious. Would that be the best way to sum up your stance?
Well, see, this is the interesting thing, right? So whenever we write articles or I do interviews, people want to try to coveyhole us into, you're either bullish or bearish. and I know that's an interesting thing, but it's not really important to us. Again, what my job is for my clients is to do two things. One is to grow their money at a rate of growth. I don't care what the S&P does from one year to the next. The S&P has nothing to do with my clients at all. My clients have a very specific time frame. They have a very specific goal that they need to achieve. And in order to benchmark to an S&P index, I've got to be like the index, which means I have to take on a tremendous amount of risk that my clients really don't need. The goal of investing, and let's strip out the conversation of Wall Street and the media hype, because let's remember, Wall Street sells products. And so we want people to constantly be moving around and jumping from one investment to another, because that's what creates revenue for Wall Street. But in reality, the reason we invest is very simple. We invest our money into the financial markets not to get rich, not to create wealth. We invest our money into the market, our savings. We work hard every day for our money. We save what few shekels that we can scratch together, and we invest those shekels into the market to make sure that they can grow at a rate that is equivalent to inflation, so that in the future, my savings have the same purchasing power parity as they have today. If I take on excess risk, I'm going to wind up destroying my savings and missing my investment goal down the road. And this is the most important lesson that investors need to learn is that when you take on excess risk, in other words, if I need a 4% rate of return and I ask my investment advisor to give me 5, well, that's a 25% increase in the rate of return. 1% on 4 is 25. So to go from 4 to 5, I'm asking to increase my rate of return by 25%. But to increase my rate of return by 25%, I have to add on almost 100% more risk. It's an exponential increase in risk that I have to take on for a very small increase in return. And of course, risk is simply nothing more than how much money I will lose when I'm wrong. Nobody ever jumped out of a plane without a parachute and says, "Hey, I love the risk."
Right.
So it's important to always understand what we're doing with our money. So as investors, I'm looking for the thing that is going to likely take. I've been managing money since 1986. I've been through the crash of 87. I've been through the dot-com crash. I've been through the bear market in 08. In 2008, we were down 8%. The market was down 52. Okay. Because what I'm looking for is the thing that's going to take away the majority of my clients' money. That's what I want to avoid. The wiggles, I don't care about. I'm invested in the markets now because the markets are going up. There is some technical, like I said earlier, there is some technical damage. There's some technical indicators right now that are suggesting that the market dynamics may have changed in the short term, and that we may have a lot more volatility here over the course of the next few months. This rally today was excellent. It was well needed. We were writing in our newsletter 2 weeks ago that we were very oversold after this sell-off. We were going to get a rally here. Well, this is the rally. This is the rally that you need to be selling into. So if that decline of 11% over the course of the last month of October really kept you up at night, if you were tossing and turning and worrying about your money, that's telling you you've got too much risk in your portfolio. This is a great opportunity to take some of that risk out of your portfolio, rebalance it to something you can withstand, right? We're always going to have volatility. And the biggest mistake that investors always make is that despite the calls of just buying and holding and writing things out, the things that investors always do, they buy the tops, they sell the bottoms because they take on too much risk. If you manage the portfolio, construct the portfolio to lower that risk, that volatility, that up and down movement, you're more apt to stay invested in your discipline and your program, your portfolio over time, and allow the markets to work for you. I'm a long-term believer that markets rise over time. I'm a long-term believer that we can invest and be successful at it. But the one thing we've got to mitigate is our emotional drive to sell when things are going wrong.
So basically, you're interested in the return of your capital more so than the return on your capital.
I could not have said it better myself.
So let's kind of get into a little bit about your firm's investment philosophy and how you're positioning your clients right now.
Sure. So our investment philosophy is, like I was saying a second ago, is that we are long-term investors. You know, it's always interesting. I get in these debates with individuals about buy and hold investing and passive indexing. And my position is always the same, which is it sounds great in theory. It doesn't work. And the only reason it doesn't work is twofold. As I said, riding the markets up and down over time, being a passive indexer is fine. You will make money over a long enough time frame. But two things are likely going to happen. One is that despite the best of intentions, when markets fall enough, everybody sells. The second thing is that riding markets up and down and spending, you know, 5, 6, 7 years getting back to even destroys 5, 6, 7 years of your compounding time that you need to get towards your retirement goal. There was an interesting article out a couple of months ago talking about, you know, how to get to $1 million for retirement. Well, $1 million is not worth $1 million anymore. See, back in 1980, if I could retire at $1 million, I could get, you know, bonds paying 10% interest and I could make $100,000 a year to live on. That's great. $1 million works fantastic. $1 million today at 3% interest on the 10-year treasury gets you $30,000 a year. That's not even poverty level. So investors have this need to adjust their required incomes based upon what they need to live. And so today, if you have a $50,000 or $60,000 a year lifestyle that you want to leave in retirement, in 30 years, that's now $120,000 just due to inflation. So now you're going to need not just $2 million in retirement, you're going to need $4 million in retirement to make that work. So if I spend a decade or two just getting back to even, I'm never going to reach the goals that I need investment-wise, inflation-adjusted over time to meet my goals. So when we talk about managing money and investing over time, I am a long-term investor. You know, there's one of the quotes by Warren Buffett that is often misquoted is that my favorite holding time is forever. My favorite holding time is forever, too. If I could buy something and never have to sell it, that would make me perfectly happy. The reality is that at some point in time, and we'd never know when it is, you wind up with a General Electric. And I use that just because it's the most recent, you know, company that's kind of blown itself up. But here's a company that was the original member of the Dow, right? Yeah. Back in 1900, you know, there was General Electric. 115 years later, here we are, and the stock is in terrible trouble. And yes, I would have loved to help GE that whole time. Reality is that most of us can only buy when we can buy, and we have to understand that when things go wrong, we need to change our philosophy and our strategy. So our investment strategy and our philosophy is very simple, is that we buy for the long term, but we manage risk in the short term. So fundamentals tell us what to buy, and then we use technical analysis to determine not only when we buy it, but also when we sell it. Because the investment philosophy that we use is and again, we're not big technicians. We don't have big, complex technical models. We're using fairly simple stuff, just some basic moving averages and looking for what the trend of the market is doing. If the trend of the market is moving higher on average, and in other words, moving averages are sloping up at a 45-degree angle or whatever they are, then we want to be invested in equity. And if the market is sloping negatively, then we don't want to be invested in equities. And so it just becomes a simple function of understanding the trend of the market and how much exposure that we want to have. And so as an example, earlier this year, in January of this year, there was a lot of conversations talking about international and emerging markets and how these were going to be just big winners because they were so cheap relative to the U.S. And I wrote an article saying they're not cheap. They're not cheap. They may be cheap relative to U.S. valuations, but they are not cheap based on their valuations. And more importantly, with trade wars and these type of issues, they're going to be the most negatively impacted. And we sold all of our international emerging market exposure and all of our basic materials and industrials in January of this year for those economic variables. Now, those were short-term economic variables that we knew were going to be impactful because of policies coming out of Washington. But also, we had already noticed a trend change occurring within those sectors. So we moved out of those sectors, and of course, those sectors have been under terrible pressure all year long. So it's alleviated a lot of the pressure off our portfolio to allow the other positions in our portfolio to do what they're supposed to do, which is to create returns for our clients.
So
understanding, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was gonna get into it. Look, what are some stocks that you like right now?
Okay, so right now, so our equity, we run three different types of portfolios, basically. We run, and all of our portfolios have fixed income in them, actual bonds. Okay. Why do we like individual bonds? We love individual bonds because they pay an income stream and they give us back our principal at maturity.
Corporate bonds?
High quality corporates.
Okay.
Everything has to be everything we buy is investment grade. Okay. So we really like high quality corporates. So we own Apple bonds as an example. I love government guaranteed bonds. So we have treasuries, we have Ginnie Mae's. Ginnie Mae's are government National Mortgage Association bonds. They pay on a monthly basis, principal and interest, and they're guaranteed by the government. We also like treasuries, and then of course we like municipals that are from good quality states and good quality municipalities that also are insured. So if we have a taxable account that needs fixed income, we really like municipals there. Now, we manage duration risk. Duration risk is important, especially when you have an environment where rates have been ticking up here lately. We've shortened our duration. Our average duration, our bond portfolio runs about 3 to 5 years. Now, I will tell you that when this debt bubble that we see pops, the area you don't want to be in is ultimately low-quality corporates, and even higher-quality corporates are going to get hit. We've minimized a lot of our risk on our corporate side by really shortening up duration. But treasuries and in particular are going to be huge beneficiaries. And in fact, I will lay you money. I'll tell you what, when I come up to see you, I'll take you to lunch, because in 5 years, bonds are going to be the best performing asset class, period. They're going to outperform stocks. They're going to outperform just about everything else, because interest rates, when we hit the next recession, are going to fall from 3% today to less than 1%, because that's going to be where money is going to, looking for safety.
Mm-hmm.
So in every portfolio we run, lots of bonds.
Okay.
The other 60% of the portfolio is, if it's in the equity model, we run 30 equities. So we run a primarily fairly concentrated portfolio. Right now, we are loving things like CVS, the pharmacy store. A pharmacy chain, love Johnson & Johnson, love Procter & Gamble. And the reason that we like these companies in particular, now we own Apple, there's some companies that, you know, basically kind of dominate their space, and fundamentally lots of cash on the balance sheet. You know, it's a well-run company, and the trend of it's very positive. So we've owned Apple for a long time. We own Nvidia. We own Nvidia because of, I watch my kids and I watch what my kids are doing in terms of, video games and, virtual reality, and Nvidia is right at the heart of all that that's coming down the road. So we like Nvidia and technology space. Now, and a lot of the semiconductors have been under a lot of pressure lately. But I think there's actually a good buying opportunity for companies like Micron and Nvidia in particular. At this point, after this recent correction, we've been these long these stocks for a while, so we don't have any issues with them. But for somebody looking for positions, these companies are fundamentally very cheap. And after this recent correction, the price is very attractive. And I think if we continue to see a growth in the economy, and particularly in the change, the dynamics of how we work, more automation, et cetera, you're going to continue to see these stocks generate a lot of return. But those are very small holdings within our portfolio. Again, we're concentrating most of the weight in our equity model right now in things that are quote unquote recession proof.
Okay. So give us some
it
examples.
It doesn't mean that they won't go down.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Oh,
CVS, Procter & Gamble,
okay.
Johnson & Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, when you know, our theory is very simple. It doesn't matter what you think about the world. You're going to buy toilet paper and toothpaste when the recession comes, right?
So, right.
You know, there's some things, it doesn't matter how bad it gets, there's certain things you're always going to buy. And so we have a lot of weight right now in staples. We also have a good bit of weight in the lower end discretionary sector. We love Walmart and Target in particular, Dollar General, because again, when you look at the makeup of 80% of Americans, you know, while you and I are talking about the stock market, by the way, let's just clear up one thing. Only 10% of Americans have actually participated with the stock market. So we have this big wealth gap in the country that was created by the Federal Reserve, and that wealth has all been shoved to the top end of the ladder. So the bottom 80 to 90% of the economy really haven't participated much. I mean, you look at the average, Philly just came up with a study talking about the average 401k plan balance was like $26,000. So most Americans have not really benefited from it. And because of that, we really like stores like Walmart, Target, Dollar General, because that's where the bulk of Americans are going to continue to shop even during a recession. They're going to come down from higher end stores and migrate to those areas. So we really like those areas too.
Okay. On your site, on the realinvestmentadvice.com, you have an interesting viewpoint on Tesla right now. So
yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, that Tesla is the epitome of the wealth bubble. So, right, we were talking about this wealth bubble a second ago, which is part and parcel of the everything bubble that we have going on, because we have a bubble in virtually every asset class, right? Bonds, stocks, real estate. We've got a bubble going just about everywhere we're going because of what we've done with low interest rates. Well, Tesla is a great example of the wealth bubble that we've created. Here's a company that, if it wasn't for government subsidies, would not be in business. They have a tremendous amount of cash burn, and if you looked at their last report, that where they reported an actual profit, that was basically due to every accounting gimmick known to man to generate the profit. They have not paid a lot of their vendors for months in order to generate that positive cash flow. So, you know, there's a lot of things with that company fundamentally that is very wrong. And ultimately, at some point, and I don't know when it's going to be, and it's amazing. Tesla's a very much like a cult stock, very much like Starbucks was when it first came out.
Right.
But at some point, that company cannot survive longer term because of a couple of reasons in particular. Is that one, they cannot produce at a rate fast enough to fill ultimate demand. I mean, there's a tremendous backlog, et cetera. But the real problem for Tesla is ultimately just going to be sheer competition. Just in the next year, you're going to see Porsche, BMW, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Ford, General Motors, et cetera, all come out with all electric cars. Audi just had a great announcement. They've got three all electric cars that are coming out, I think, in the next model year. And they had the best statement. They said, we're very proud of our new line of all electric vehicles. And the best thing is that we can actually produce them. So, and that's the problem. And that's going to be the big issue for Tesla, is that their competition is going to ultimately crush them. Their competition of these major auto manufacturers, they know how to produce, they know how to deliver, they have the logistics, and they can lower the cost to a level where they can basically not only undercut Tesla, but ultimately do it without government subsidies. And there is already conversations in Congress, at least there was prior to the midterm elections, about removing subsidies from electric vehicles as well, because again, it's subsidizing losing business, and it's a subsidizing losing business model in particular. And again, when you're running a Trump point, you're going to have to start cutting spending, and subsidies are a very easy place to start cutting because nobody wants to really get into trying to deal with Social Security and Medicare.
So, right. So you kind of see Tesla as the poster child of the wealth bubble.
Hey, Jack?
Yes, Lance, you there? Lance?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, so essentially, you see Tesla as the poster child of the wealth bubble.
Yeah.
So your main concern with Tesla is what? Is the competition, price competition coming in? Is that going to be the main factor? Hello?
Well, no. The two main factors for Tesla is going to be A, the competition from other auto manufacturers that can produce at a higher rate, at a higher quality, and a lower price than Tesla can. And the second issue is ultimately going to be if there is a retraction of government subsidies for electric vehicles, Tesla's got a real problem. Fundamentally, Tesla is a wreck. And so if they can't get to a point where they can produce at a level and have the and meet the demand at a point where they can produce a profit, a real profit without doing a lot of accounting gimmicks, then they're not going to stay in. They're not ultimately going to be able to stay in business at the current run rate that they're going. So they've got to get their business model cleaned up and turned around. And I'm just not sure that they're going to be able to do that.
Okay, but you don't think that Tesla is kind of like like the 1980s version of Apple versus the IBM, the PC clones. I mean, does it have enough brand, that kind of brand fanaticism, loyalty, that's gonna make it succeed versus the Audis, the BMWs of the world that can probably like you're saying, can produce competitive product.
Well, yeah. Well, look, and it's a good comparison. It's an interesting comparison you bring up. If you remember, Apple struggled for like 20 years.
Right.
So, they were producing Macs, but they had very little market share. They were a very niche computer for a very long, long time. It wasn't really until the turn of the century when they invented the iPhone and the iPad that things really turned for Apple. But if you'd owned Apple since 1980, you really didn't make a whole lot of money with it for like almost 20 years. But it's an interesting comparison that you bring up. The difference between Apple in 1980 and Tesla today is that, a Mac cost, a couple hundred bucks then, not $80,000 for a car. So it's always going to be ultimately about quantity and quality. So can Tesla produce a quality vehicle? I won't argue with it. They produce a really, really cool vehicle, but they produce a vehicle that is out of the reach of most Americans. So there, and then there's some other issues about range and, of course, energy conversion, et cetera, which, despite this idea that we're going to all move to electric vehicles ultimately, which may ultimately be the case someday, I don't know when, but I have a family of four. You're not cramming a family of four into a Tesla to go across country for a vacation. So, it's a very niche market, and it's a very niche vehicle. But again, it's a neat idea, but the problem is the business model is not profitable. Apple made money, and they could produce a quality product. Even in the 80s and 90s, they could produce a quality product. I'll spit that out, and produce a profit. Tesla is unable to do that. And the problem for Tesla is that other competitors in the field can produce a higher quality product. For instance, I don't know if you've seen Porsche's new vehicle that they're coming out with, but their all electric Porsche is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous piece of artwork. If they get that thing produced on the ground and they can produce at a rate and a quality to A, meet demand, so you don't have these people waiting around for a Tesla for 6 months or a year. People want what they want, right? So you may love the idea of buying a Tesla, and you go get in line and you put your deposit down And then Porsche comes out with this really cool, Porsche they can deliver in a month. You're probably going to pull your deposit and go buy the Porsche because you want what you want right now.
Right.
So people have a brand loyalty to a point, but it's only to the point to where convenience isn't eroded. And once convenience becomes an issue, they will switch products. And again, with BMW, Porsche, Mercedes, they also have quality brand names. There's right. also an issue. And I tell you, here's one last thing with Tesla. Tesla has a huge problem coming, and it's starting right now. Everybody that bought a Tesla 5 years ago is now coming out of warranty. There is nowhere to get service on a Tesla.
Huh.
With a Porsche or Mercedes or BMW, I can go to any auto dealer. I can go to the dealerships. They're everywhere, and I can get my car serviced and updated, whatever needs to happen to it. So there's a guy on YouTube right now that's actually disassembled his entire Tesla, and he's now producing videos about how to maintenance the Tesla once it's out of warranty. Do it yourself.
Right.
That's gonna be another issue down the road.
Yeah, I never understood Tesla. I mean, I'm probably gonna get a lot of hate mail, but I think it's an ugly car. I just think the whole thing is just it doesn't make sense to me. But I know guys who are serious car guys, and they say that they would love to own a Tesla. But I would think that once there's Porsche or Audi, can produce an electric vehicle, which, and they have much better styling. I'm sure they can do much better interiors. I mean, that would bring real competition. But I guess the real question I was asking is, can Tesla end up as one of these kind of cult products, almost like Apple? Apple was always a relatively cult product. I mean, I use an Apple. I don't like Apple, but I still use it because it's convenient for certain things, and it's just a little bit easier. Although I don't use the iPhone, it's one of those things.
The reality is I don't think Tesla is going to be around in its current form for another decade. As an example, two things are going to happen. Either A, the accounting issues and the fundamental issues, or I should say lack of fundamental issues for the company, are going to catch up with the company sooner rather than later. There is a real probability that this company is going to run into a financial stress type situation, particularly during a recession. When we hit a recession, this is where it's going to show up. So in the next 12 to 18, 24 months, if you see Tesla at that point trading at less than half its value, don't be surprised. A lot of these things that he's doing internally to kind of float the company are not sustainable. Now, the reality is that at some point there are some great components to Tesla that if I am General Motors or I'm Ford or I am Audi or Fiat or Chrysler or some or Jeep, right? Some of these other brand names that maybe haven't delved as far into developing an electric vehicle, Tesla is going to be a great takeout target at some point to acquire the technology.
I think the real 420 a share?
No. You're going to be talking about buying the stock. The stock will get acquired somewhere between $50 and $100 a share.
Okay.
That's about what its fundamental value. Their fundamental value is about $50 a share. So you slap a premium on it, maybe you get $100 for it.
Got it. Okay. So all right. So let's finish off with kind of telling us what kind of clients does Clarity work with, and what do you do for them? Like, what's a typical account size that you take on and that type of thing?
Sure. Our clients are just normal people, everyday people. We made a decision several years ago that we wanted to focus on, the everyday folk. There's a deviation within the finance environment, which is if you've got more than $5 million, Wall Street loves you. and they're going to really cater to you. And especially if you've got $20 or $30 million, they're going to really cater to you as a client. They're going to really kind of delve into actual portfolio management. Then they're going to provide you a and those clients are few and far between. Below $1 million, people, especially a lot of
Lance, I'm sorry,
they're not really that interested.
Know, Lance, I'm sorry, the connection just broke up. So maybe can you repeat?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So you were saying Wall Street caters. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So Wall Street caters to people, families with over $5 million. Below $1 million, it's pretty much, you know, buy and hold, get into some mutual funds, and, you know, just kind of ride it out. And there's this gap between $1 to $5 million, and there's a lot of people in this country that have $1 million saved up. They work for, you know, companies, they've got 401k plans, they've got, you know, money invested in, but they're pretty much stuck in these kind of standard ideals that, you know, just kind of buy and hold, buy some mutual funds and kind of hope for the best. And so Clarity Financial made a conscious decision several years ago to focus on individuals below $5 million that need, you know, quality institutional style portfolio management, risk management, paying real attention to what risks are in portfolios, and really working with individuals that are approaching to and within like 10 years of retirement and post-retirement, and particularly where income generation and capital preservation become really key. Because once you're in your income distribution years, the last thing that you can really afford is a big reduction in principal, which reduces your income flow. So Clarity's focus is for individuals that, you know, pretty much our clients run from $250,000 up to $5 million. Our average account size runs about $750,000 to $1 million. And they are individuals that are just normal, everyday, hardworking Americans. They get up, they go to work, they work a job, they save in their 401k plans. They've got, you know, the wife and two kids and a dog, and they're just normal. They're your guys. They're your neighbors. They're your everyday Americans. And they're just a great group of people. And they're just very concerned about where this country's headed. They look at, you know, how we're running up the debt for the government. And, you know, we're running a $1 trillion deficit during an economic expansion. You run deficits of $1 trillion during massive recessions. So, you know, they understand what the risks are. And they understand that this bubble that we're in, particularly now that the Fed is hiking interest rates are moving up, there is not one single period in history where the Federal Reserve was hiking rates that did not either end in a recession or some type of crisis. And that goes back to 1954. So, you know, we have all the ingredients in place for a capital destruction process within 24 to 36 months. And so our goal now is to grow money while we can grow it, but protect those assets against the decline when it comes. It's not if it's going to come. It's not if we're going to have a recession. We are going to have a recession. It is going to come. And if the Fed continues to aggressively hike rates going into next year, that time frame could be shortened dramatically over the course of the next 12 months. And during a recession, stocks lose on average about 33% of their value. So that's the type of capital destruction that we are looking to avoid through both really proper asset allocation and also risk management.
Okay, so Lance, anybody that wants to get a hold of you, how do they contact you?
Oh, best way to go, and look, we've been doing this for years, is to go to our website. We run two websites. So we have our corporate website, myclarityfinancial.com, which is, you know, kind of our corporate website. But we run a website called realinvestmentadvice.com. And the great thing about that site is that we post articles and blogs every day, but you can ask a question and I answer every question every day before I go home from work. So if you have a question about your money, your investments, your portfolio, you need help, whatever it is, you click the ask a question button and I'll answer it before the end of the day.
Excellent. Lance, thank you for your time, and look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Absolutely. Love to do it anytime, Jack.